Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Almost like we have that timed. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and things to think about. Today we've got more remarkable stuff comes up. It's really amazing. Last week we did a program on alexithymia. Alexithymia, which is a sense of dullness that many people have. It's a sense where they could feel no feelings or identify no feelings. So it's a very interesting program. I mean, we got some fascinating response from people who never had heard of it before. You could still, if you want to learn about it, we could show you how to get it. But from this alexithymia comes this other part, which is there are people who don't feel any feelings. Comes the question, are there people who don't cry? Which leads us into an investigation of crying. Fascinating. Tighten your seatbelts, my friends, and especially you therapists, because I'm changing my mind. Mm-hmm. I used to think that all you had to do was cry and you would automatically get better. And in fact, that's a standard for my field. The field of psychology, which we're going to talk about, is crying good for you? Just a quote for you. The Finney and I didn't consider that main therapeutic task to be breaking down the blocks which keep a client from crying and then getting him or her to accept comfort while continuing to discharge their hurt through their tears. And therefore, crying can be directly linked to recovery. We're going to look at that and examine that because we came up with some other information. But before we do, my friends, let's talk about crying and tears and sobbing and weeping. What is it? What is this stuff that happens? Roberta, physiology of tears themselves.
Sure, Armand. Tears are, first of all, a lubricant fluid produced by a gland that is specialized to produce them, which is located in the lower eyelid.
That's the lacrimal gland, right?
Upper eyelid, yes, yes.
Lacrimal,
because from Latin, lacrima means tear.
I used to think it was lacrima.
That's the name
lacrimal,
of tear.
But it's really lacrimal.
That's the English version.
The English version of the lacrimal gland.
Right. So why do we produce them all the time? Because it's not just during weeping or crying that we tear. It's all the time the eye needs to be wet, because if it's not, then all of the dust and the debris and the particles, the little flies, anything that could enter the eye could get stuck there and cause problems. But with the constant lubrication, things are all the time being removed from the inside of the eye so that the eye is kept lubricated and clean.
So tears are one of the way that we keep it, and they contain salt. You know, we talk about crying salty tears. The salt they contain acts as the lubricant. Without the moisture provided by tears, our eyeballs would scrape painfully on the insides of our eyelids.
It feels like having sand in your eyes if there's no liquid in the eye.
The label of eye drop and contact lens products show you they usually contain salt. If you take a look, they contain salt. Tears also contain a mild germicide called lysozyme.
It's an enzyme, and it's something that if you have bacteria in excess, actually in the eye there are gazillions of bacteria all the time, but normally they're not harmful. But the lysozyme is there to make sure that if there is a possibility of this bacteria being harmful or being there in excess, then the lysozyme would take care of it, would destroy it. And also, I wanted to say, Armand, that you said, let's look at crying versus weeping, sobbing. It's interesting that all human beings, babies, start with one kind of crying, right? That kind that's the typical of babies. It's, I've never seen a baby weep. Have you?
Hmm. Never thought about it.
Right. So it's interesting. We start from a kind that is seems to be a common behavior to all humans, to boys and girls equally, and then it changes.
All right, well, let's go back. We haven't described yet weeping, crying, sobbing. We haven't done that yet. Let's go to the differences. All right? Crying. We talk about crying. We talk about the difference between weeping and crying. Weeping tears leaking from your eyes, you know what I mean? That's weeping. But crying has got paroxysms. Now, a paroxysm is a convulsive movement. There are staccato sounds of crying, the sobbing.
It's also involuntary.
But it could be controlled.
Yes, but
involuntary,
in
but could
part,
be controlled.
I mean, when you cry, a lot of the movements are not conscious.
They're very predictable.
Right.
So there's tension of the lips. A person tends to look down when they're crying. They hide their face, which is an interesting phenomenon. Almost everybody who cries puts their hands over their eyes. And I think there's a second reason for it. It's not just shame, but it may have to do with light, which we'll talk about in a minute, because it's we did some phenomenal research on light and how light affects serotonin and so on and so forth. Now, here's the interesting thing about crying, Roberta. Snot. It's just snot what I was going to ask. No, what is all this stuff coming out of the nose when a person cries? You know, a person cries and you tell them, you know, you can put your head on my shoulder, there goes a good shirt.
Right.
What is that stuff?
Well, the inside of the nose is comprised of a tissue called mucosa. This is a tissue that we have on the inside of other parts of the body, like the inside of the intestines, the inside of the ear, the inside of the mouth. And it's a kind of tissue that is less sturdy than the skin, but it is a kind of skin, and it's more delicate, and it needs a constant lubricant on it, which is mucus. It comes from the word mucosa. It produces mucus all the time to keep itself lubricated, because when the mucus is missing, a mucosa is much more vulnerable to infection than your normal skin.
It's a very big answer.
Okay.
What is that stuff coming out of my nose?
It's mucus.
Okay, and why is mucus coming out? Because we have, what's the danger? If you're crying, why do you have to get so much mucus out of your nose?
Well, it's not a danger. It's that when you cry, there is an overproduction of mucus and fluids and tears, and it's just part of that behavior.
What do you mean, tears coming out of your nose? I'm playing straight man, because
yes,
I know the answer to this. And it's kind of fascinating. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We're talking about crying and sobbing. We want you to understand it. If you don't cry, you know, if you're a man, I'm only kidding. Mm. But if you don't cry and you want to understand crying, this is very good. Mm-hmm. If you want to understand it in your children, this is very good. If you want to understand it in yourself, this is very good. If you want to hear music, this is not very good. Okay, but crying through your nose, what do you mean?
Right. Well, when you cry, when the tears are being expelled from the eye, there is a movement, is an outflow, but there's also an inflow increase, meaning that an increase of secretions is also going on the inside of the eye and the inside of the nose and the inside of the throat, so that the tears that come out are only the visible ones. There are also tears that are invisible because they're being shed on the inside, and
so
those are the ones you feel
in your throat and in your nose,
and the, you know, that's the reason why we we tend to swallow a lot more when we cry because of all the tears secreted on the inside.
This is Armando Robertacci. Now, listen to this. You know, you heard about people laughing on the outside and crying on the inside. Mm-hmm. You know, crying on the inside, you cry a lot more on the inside than you do on the outside, is what our research shows. That when you cry on the outside, there's a certain amount of water coming out, certain amount of this lacrimal fluid coming out, which
and
is fed by water.
And you are aware of it?
And on the inside, there's an enormous amount. I don't know what the ratio is, but I know it's bigger. And so that stuff coming out of your nose is also tears.
And I also have noticed that when people do not want to cry outwardly, let's say that they are embarrassed, sometimes the inside crying is increased so that people may say, oh, I have a lot of mucus in my throat.
So one of the signs of people inhibiting crying, which we're going to go to in a couple of minutes, is an increase of mucosa
right.
inside and something else. They think it's mucus. In fact, mucus formation, or people who think they have sometimes sinus drips,
right,
really may be crying
it
on the inside.
It could be tears, yes.
You know, and it could be all that it's about.
And what they do is in part alexithymic because they disconnect from the awareness of the process, so it may be happening without them knowing that indeed they are weeping.
So people that don't cry may in effect cry, and then people who don't weep, there are some people who never weep, they would easily weep on the inside, and that
right.
could be interpreted in any number of ways, because remember again, weeping on the inside without it coming out of your body can easily be filled with an enormous amount of bacteria
mm-hmm.
that doesn't belong down in your throat and in your, you know.
And you could think it's a form of allergy, for instance.
Yeah, you could say, I have allergies, and you really could be crying.
Right.
You could be sad.
Yeah.
And that a good cry may actually get this stuff out of your body, and you could feel purged
mm-hmm.
of that thing which you thought was your allergic reaction.
Right.
This is theory, but we're gonna teach you more about this, and you're gonna find a lot of evidence for it. Let's talk about people who don't. Well, some more facts about crying. When it takes place?
Takes place mostly in the evening.
Mostly in the evening.
Mostly in the evening. Mostly at home, and mostly when the person is either alone or with one other person.
Or a dog or a cat.
Or
two
a pet.
Cats.
Yes, or a pet. Right.
And weeping also, as I think all deeply emotional states last about 20 to 22 minutes.
Right.
Crying rarely lasts more than 30 minutes.
Right, right.
Except in the case of depression, which we're going to talk about as we get further into this. And my friends, here's what's important for therapists. We've uncovered evidence that crying may be counterproductive to ending depression. We're going to talk more about that.
Yeah,
it's just
right.
it's just mind-boggling mm-hmm. to think about it, because if I think of how many therapists I know who validate crying,
mm-hmm.
as I do.
Sure. Well, but I mean, there is an aspect that is
curative.
Cathartic. Catharsis means purification.
Well, what is catharsis?
Catharsis
it's a Greek word.
Is a Greek word, and it means literally purification.
So you could have a catharsis from working out in a gym.
Yes.
From sweating, you can
yes.
have a catharsis.
But the word is normally used to mean that someone has had a cry that reached a peak of emotional intensity, and then once at the peak, it suddenly decreased. So it's a typical, it's a way of describing one type of this behavior. Cathartic is when someone expresses a lot of sadness all at once, with a lot of the behaviors that accompany the experience of that emotion. And that is believed to be to bring relief,
and it
both
does.
Emotionally and physically, and it's also associated with an improvement, with an increase in the level of immunity in the body.
We're going to talk more about that. We're going to come back to that. Before we do, let's go back to two other aspects of crying. There's the physiological, which we are talking about now. Then there's the psychological, which we're going to come back to. Cultural anthropological, kind of very interesting.
Very interesting.
Let's talk about some of the cultural anthropo-
Anthropological.
Anthropological.
Right. Well, what's interesting to me, Armand, is, as I mentioned before, is that all humans seem to cry the same way up until the age of about 11 or so, or maybe 13, up to puberty. And then girls continue to cry and boys stop. So that in adults, you are going to see 50% more women who allow themselves to cry than men. That's number one.
That's not number very two, many.
Well, it's significant. 50%
more means 3 to 2. I don't know the two guys who cry.
So maybe I'm off with that number.
Okay.
Maybe I'm saying it wrong. But no, I think it's a lot more than 1 to 2.
Mm-hmm.
Probably even more than that.
Right.
Probably for every 5 women, maybe you'll find one man.
One man who allows himself to truly cry.
Right.
Now there could be, you know, and we're not saying that this is just conditioned, because it seems kind of obvious that men are taught, don't cry, you know, because it's not masculine. But there's probably even more to it, you know. There's probably more that it weakens you in a certain way, that in order to cry, you've got to kind of stop and become vulnerable.
Yes, and if you look at many of the things we talked about when we talked about evolution of the species, you realize that when you're out hunting and you're focused on getting something for your family to eat, even if you hurt yourself, you're not likely to indulge in a crying spell, because it's going to compromise your ability to get food to feed your kids. Also, if you're on a hunt, you're not likely to allow yourself to be sad, because it just doesn't go with the activity. You
and
know?
It does dehydrate you.
Right.
You know, and it does. I mean, it does dehydrate.
And it brings your attention inside, whereas when you're on the hunt, your attention really needs to be outside. You need to be focused with what is going on in your environment, not what is going on inside you.
So why do women cry more than men? This is very interesting, and we're going to get right back to that. Before we do, long ago in the eastern part of the world, it was customary for people who were mourning, I mean, this is the most common reason to cry, to catch their tears in bottles called tear bottles. I actually have one that was sent to me by a friend who discovered it when digging. A tear bottle,
wow.
Which was what you would do. Actually, the one I got was from, it was a Roman tear bottle.
Hmm.
And the Romans would be, when they were on the march, 100 AD, they had conquered 2/3 of the known world. So they would go to, you know, they'd be traveling around. So you've got a boyfriend, you know, you're 16 years old and you've got a husband who just joined the army and he went to Egypt. It takes him 2 years to get to Egypt by horseback.
Right.
So now you want to send him a gift. What are you going to send him? You're going to write him a note on papyrus, you know, Hallmark papyrus. I miss you, right?
There.
It's going to take a couple of years to get there. You want to send
him. By the time it gets there, the paper is not going to be paper anymore, you know?
So you want to send him something significant. What people used to do is women would carry a vial around their neck called a tear vial, and it was actually called a lacrimonial, believe it or not, a lacrimonier. Lacrimonial, it was.
Lacrimarius?
Yes, and they were vials filled with the tears of the person who loved you. And she would cry, and she'd weep into this tear bottle, and then they would take this tear bottle, which was made of glass. The Romans invented glass. And they would put it in a package, and they would send it to their man wherever he was. Now, and then they would find him, and he'd get mail, and in his mail he gets a tear bottle. Now,
how romantic.
It got even more romantic than that. One of my friends, Moshe Davidowitz, who was an archaeologist, was digging in Egypt. And he found a skeleton of a Roman warrior. He found the armor of the warrior still on the soldier with a piercing from a spear. And then he found under the armor a broken tear bottle.
Aww.
So here's what this meant. The man received, a young man received his tear bottle from his wife or girlfriend, but I think it was wives. He had it around his chest so he could hold her tears next to his heart. And when he died, the spear broke the bottle.
Hmm.
And so the last thing that happened to him as he died was her tears went over his chest.
Hmm. Wow.
Isn't that something? So Moshe sent me this tear bottle. Which I have to this day. Yes, 2,000 years old. Someday I've got to bring it in and show it to you.
I'd love to see it. Mm. One thing I read while I was doing this research was that in Colombia, if one is convinced that one has a bad spell on oneself, you know, like a magic spell, in order to get rid of it, one needs to cry a lot.
Now, they thought in Colombia, they thought it came from an evil eye.
Right.
And the evil eye is a common thing in a lot of different cultures.
Yes, evil eye. So the what you need to do if you believe you have a spell on you of this sort, you need to cry a lot, and the tears will get rid of the spell to the point where if the person was not able to cry, he or she would get himself beaten in order to be able to cry enough to feel that one was free of that spell.
This may be the answer to BDSM. And I don't only mean that as a joke. It may be the reason that acting out masochists like to be punished.
Well, I was also reading in Italy in the Middle Ages, people, nuns and monks, they would hurt themselves, sometimes very seriously, because they would get into a crying spell that would give them a mystical experience of ecstasy. And, I mean, that's part of what you're saying, that maybe that's where masochistic behavior, you know, maybe that's where its origins are. That indeed, from pain and despair and crying, one can reach an altered state that can be exquisite.
Like New Jersey or Connecticut. Okay, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Leonardo da Vinci, 1452, right? That's when he was born. Famous even in his own time as a master painter, a sculptor, an architect, a musician, an engineer, a scientist, an inventor, created drawings of the inner workings of the human body that have been accurate now, even to the smallest detail. Yet in one of his drawings, he shows a tube going directly from the tear ducts to the heart. And this is the only anatomical incorrect depiction of the human crying mechanism that they ever found with him, Leonardo da Vinci.
But you know,
however, unscientific.
Armand, when I read that, I thought, no, he did it on purpose. The guy was too smart to be mistaken. I think he was saying something with that.
Well, maybe in 1492, there was a tube going from the eyes to the heart, and then somewhere around the discovery of America, the duct got broken, and that's when your tears started coming out as snot.
Well, that could be.
You know, it started coming out of the nose.
Right.
I hope you find this all interesting. We are going to get to it in this whole idea of crying. I want to get for a moment to this whole idea of what women and crying and serotonin. We want to talk about this for a moment because one of the most common times of crying is when serotonin is shaken up. Now, before we talk about that, here's a notice from the American Psychological Association. The greatest psychologist of all time, you know, William Shakespeare, said, "Beware the Ides of March." It's March 13th. During the month of March, there are 81 more minutes of sunshine to the day. Serotonin levels swing upward in response. Patients who have been very depressed feel energized. Patients who are bipolar, that means manic depressive, go from depressed to manic in early March. The results can be dangerous. Of the 14 major school shootings, 12 occurred during the first 2 weeks of March. So did the mass murder suicides in Waco, Texas, the recent killings in Chicago. So the APA sent out a note saying, please watch your patients carefully for shifts in serotonin. Now, serotonin is very interesting. You have too little serotonin, you wind up with a depressed state. Adequate serotonin is good for you, but a surge in serotonin could also be bad for you.
Mm. Yes, well, I'm thinking that maybe this warning that was sent out by the American Psychiatric Association is directly addressing the patients who are on antidepressants, because most of the antidepressants that are prescribed today are the so-called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which means it's a long way to say that they prevent serotonin from being destroyed and or reabsorbed in the dendrite, in the nervous system, so that there's more serotonin available. Now, when women go through the premenstrual phase, their serotonin levels sometimes drop to very low levels, and that is, we think, one of the reasons why women have a lot more crying behavior during PMS than at other times. And Armand was saying that even when serotonin is in excess, it can be a problem. Yes, except that when it's lacking, what you have is depression, is lack of energy, is anhedonia. When it's in excess, you have violent, aggressive behavior.
More tendency towards violence.
But both of them, yes.
But let's go back for a second, Roberta. And I know we only have 2 minutes before we have to take a break, but serotonin and water on the brain. Mm. You believe that most PMS is the result of excess fluid, don't you?
Yes, and this is my own observation. When women are in PMS phase, they cry a lot because, in my view, the brain is waterlogged. Now, think of it, Armand, if the brain is encaged inside the skull and there's no room there, even a little, very small amount of excess fluid can make a big difference in the way the conductivity of the nerves functions, so that
which accounts for migraine headaches,
exactly,
being part of a PMS syndrome,
and all of the mood dysfunctions, and including the crying. I mean, during PMS, when a woman is able to cry, she feels some relief, in my view, because she allows herself to let go of this fluid in excess, which is inside the brain, and it hurts. And if it's not hurting on the physical level, it hurts on the emotional level. It gives a sense of being just unable to cope with life.
So you mean even something like lacrimal fluid and you're saying mucosa, all of that has to be released, and it'll release the brain as well through crying?
The eyes are part of the brain, Armand. In fact, the eyes are the brain. Visible. The only visible part of the brain are the eyes. So it makes sense that if the brain is waterlogged, the eyes would are the only escape, really, for extra fluid. It's the only way that the excess water can come out.
Boy, oh boy. Boy, oh boy. This is a lot of information, but I don't know about you. If you want to get a copy of today's program, you're going to have to call for this one, 212-757-4488, in case you have to leave us. We're going to continue with this, and we're going to talk about some of the benefits and disadvantages of crying when you're depressed. We're going to talk about it on a level of psychotherapy. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to.
Oh my God. And my mother got us in suicide singing. Oh my God. And my mother got us living in the side singing. Oh my God. And my mother got us living suicide singing.
Okay, Armand, oh, here we go. Go ahead, go ahead.
Santa Lucia by Birdsong. A little energetic break in there. Should be dancing a little bit because we're talking about something very interesting. Here we are talking in a non-depressed way about crying. Crying, weeping, sobbing. People who weep. I could tell you, I'm a good weeper. I feel proud. I think crying very often is an attempt to hold back the weep. You know, I think that there's a natural state of being where, without hiding it, your tears just flow. You know, Roberta? Mm-hmm. Sure. You see something really sad. Well, there's a lot of different reasons why.
Well, but actually, I wanted to say that crying also can come from excessive joy, excessive, with intense joy. I mean, you know, people have been known to cry when they're very happy. When there is an emotional intensity that is overwhelming for the nervous system, tears are likely to come out.
You know, I once trained with a psychoanalyst early on, and he was talking about crying, and I said, yeah, but you know, people cry at weddings out of joy. He said, nah, they're crying because it's not them. He was not a happy guy. No. Hey, let's talk about this whole idea of serotonin, just for a minute, let's just stick with it, that crying, that a drop in serotonin can lead to depression, right? And that,
Well, there's a connection between the eyes. Yeah, I think you mentioned it a few minutes ago. There's a connection between the drop in serotonin and the amount of light.
Because in the
retina, there is actually, believe it or not, there is a synthesizing of serotonin going on. And when light increases, as it does in March, there is a 300% increase of the production of serotonin in the eye itself. In other words, the light stimulates production of serotonin in the retina of the eye, and therefore in the whole brain and nervous system, you have an increase in the levels of serotonin.
I remember Gary Null once saying that you can't get a really powerful sleep unless there is absolutely no light source in the room. You know, and I used to wonder about that because I'm one of those people, if you got a light somewhere, it disturbs my sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't disturb it. It just means I don't really get the depth of that sleep. Right. Put me in a pitch black room, I love it. I love it. I could stay in there forever without waking. But the light of daybreak will wake me up, as I guess it's meant to do.
Yes, because it has to do with melatonin, which is actually a variation on serotonin. Melatonin is a hormone produced by the pituitary and pineal. And melatonin is so important for regulating all the functions in the body that have to do with some kind of a rhythm. So but melatonin can only be secreted in darkness at night when you sleep.
And my name is Armand de Melatonin.
Oh, so that's
so
why.
So I need it. But light also stimulates the hypothalamus through the eye, you know, and the hypothalamus regulates sleeping. It's a regulatory agency. You got a hypothalamus that's not working well, or if you sell your hypothalamus, you may be in trouble because it regulates sleeping, eating, body temperature, sexual drive. Depression is the absolute opposite.
Do you sell your hypothalamus on the net, or do you go to a wholesaler? Where do you go?
I need a hypothalamus transplant. But depression, you know, is kind of the opposite of a stimulated hypothalamus, because depression is kind of the opposite of the regulation of sleeping, eating. All of the signs of depression are the absence of a high-functioning hypothalamus, which means the absence of light. in effect.
Well, that's why a lot of people who suffer from depression do better in the summer, do better when they have access to more light, do better in the tropics, right, when they take a vacation and go to Jamaica.
That's why there are no therapists in Jamaica.
Is that why?
Because you got sunshine.
There's sunshine, right.
And hypothalamus. And I think, Roberta, seasonal affective disorder, SAD, which is appropriately named, is the absence of available light, and because it's absent, the person has a reaction and they get depressed, and they have a lack of serotonin, and they have a lack of that regulatory thing that brings about proper sleeping, proper eating, proper body temperature, and the sex drive. It goes dead.
Right. Right.
With depression.
You know what I was thinking as I was listening to you, that I'm more likely to associate depressed people with weeping rather than a forceful cry,
uh-huh.
Right? And people who are not depressed, if they do cry, it's more active. There's more movement. There's more expression. It's more... There's energy there. Weeping seems to not have much energy.
Boy, you're right. You're right at the punchline right now. We're going to get to that because that's the difference between depression, right, and not being depressed and crying or not crying as part of the cure. Before we get there, which we're going to go to in a couple of minutes because I know you people have been waiting for this, what are the common reasons why people cry?
Well, reasons could be a sense of inadequacy or loneliness or a loss. Loss is, I think, the most common reason.
The most common one is a threat of separation.
Right.
Threat of separation.
Which is a threat of loss.
Yeah. A feeling of inadequacy. Feelings of rejection. Feelings of powerlessness. Feelings of frustration. And feelings of betrayal.
I think loneliness should go in there, too.
Well, loneliness comes in a different area. These come to the triggers. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the triggers. Let's talk about loss as a trigger.
Oh, the triggers. Yeah, the triggers. It could be something that happens suddenly, like the loss of a pet, the loss of a person, the loss of a job, or the loss of something important. So that's
when we talk about a trigger... We talk about a switch that gets turned in you.
Right.
When you could be in a non-crying state, and then suddenly something happens.
Right.
So loss of.
Right.
Loss of a job. Suddenly, you're fired. Boom, the tears come up. Boom, you lose your home. I mean, you look at the tsunami victims. You know, I mean, they were dazed, many of them, and many of them, of course. It's like, my home is gone. Loss of your pet is a big deal, and loss of people. These are the most common triggers of that will... And when we say triggers, we mean we have reasons for crying, and then we have the trigger, the thing that throws you over the edge. Now we have another thing, which is a reason... A trigger, which is chronic difficulties. Now, this means it's not a one-time thing, but it's an accumulation.
Yes, things like the inability to make ends meet.
Money.
Money
problems. Money worries. Money worries accumulated after a while. And there are times I remember in my life when I was a kid, I was like 16 and I was trying to get 17. I was trying to get ends meet. I had like $5 and I had an electric bill and I had to pay my rent bill and I just couldn't get to it. And I just felt completely frustrated by my desire and my powerlessness over making the ends meet. And I felt like crying.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And many people go through that.
Or it could be when you worry about someone. Maybe you're a parent and you worry about your children. Maybe you miss them. So it's something over which you have no control. And it's a situation that is hard for you to cope with. And the crying behavior seems to help with the coping with that difficulty.
Reasons why people cry. Loneliness, chronic difficulty. Loneliness, you just get tired of being alone. I'm so tired of being alone. I'm so tired of being alone. It kind of gets to you. Fear. You get tired of being afraid. sometimes you shiver to the point where you just can't stand it, and you're afraid of everything. And when there were these yellow warnings and red warnings and orange warnings going out, there were people who were trembling from fear. And they would go home, and they would cry because the fear accumulated. We'll talk about the effect of that. Another thing that triggers people is memories.
That's a big one.
And fantasies.
Because, of course, if you lost someone, every time you think about them, the memory is enough to trigger crying. And fantasies, let's say that you imagine that someone you care about no longer loves you, or that you've disappointed them in some way, and it may not be true. But just imagining it, just the fantasy of it, is enough to trigger crying. So we could actually induce ourselves to cry just by, imagining things or remembering things.
Or remembering, sure. I've got losses in my life I could just think back of and bring the tears right up.
I think everyone does.
There are two others, Roberta, that come about. There are tears of shame and tears of embarrassment. And there's those are kind of interesting. Tears of shame and tears of embarrassment. What do you think caused those?
I think that is caused by a sense of having one's boundaries being trespassed, the tears of shame, right? And so, well, where's the loss there? The loss is, in my view, the loss of self, because...
Well, we didn't say that all crying and all tears seem to in some way be connected to a loss.
Right.
So when you have tears of shame and tears of embarrassment, you look for where's the loss.
Where's the loss? And it's, in my view, this is my own explanation, is there's a sense of loss of self. If you try to think of a time when you... cried out of shame or embarrassment, if you think about it for a moment, you realize most likely that you felt like a part of you had been exposed that should not have been exposed. So there's a loss of boundary, there's a loss of self for that part.
One more part on the physiology, Roberta. Inhibited crying, people who don't cry, there's kind of signs of it. They hold their lips together. There's a kind of a grimace. Did you ever see somebody holding back tears? They have tightened facial muscles. They have jerky movements. They're shutting their eyes. The tendency is to look upward because looking downward generally will bring on an emotional outburst, so they kind of look upward instead. There's a desire to escape, and they do escape movements like walking. Now, another thing that they do is eat. They'll immediately rush to food, which works, doesn't it?
It does work, and also drinking works, not just necessarily alcohol, but anything. And
water?
Yes, anything.
So if somebody is on the verge of tears, and they need to control themselves, and they're doing deep sobs, very often someone brings them a drink of water,
right.
And believe it or not, it works.
It works. And I believe it's because swallowing stops the contraction of the throat, the knot in the throat that people describe as the beginning of a crying spell, the knot in the throat, Armand. That's most people will say, I have a knot in my throat. When you drink something or eat something, the throat has to relax. So the knot is kind of, for the moment at least, stopped, suspended, dissolved. And I think that that's why it's effective. It works.
I had a patient who once came to me who said that she constantly drank water. She always carried bottles of water with her. And she was always drinking water. And she said when she came into session, she took out two bottles of water. And she said, I'm going to be drinking a lot. And one would imagine that means she has to go to the bathroom a lot. But she didn't. She must have had a bladder the size of a house, mm-hmm. you know. And she was drinking and drinking, and then one session when she came back, I said, don't drink, and she cried.
Wow. Amazing.
And the drinking was stopping her tears the
Amazing.
Whole time.
Yeah.
Smoking cigarettes, another way.
That's a big one, yes.
That's a big one. I think most smokers are criers in drag.
Well, because, you know, with cigarettes, the big one there is that it increases dopamine so significantly that if you are about to cry and you light up a cigarette, you'll have such a sudden increase in dopamine levels that it'll change your mood. you know?
And the other thing that people who cry very often do is they get rageful. Anger, rage, screaming, annoying kind of behavior, you know, getting annoyed. This is another cover-up for the attempt to cry. Now, these are the things that are going on, and oh, do I wish we had more time to do this. We may have to do it at another time, but I do want to get to this idea of depression and crying as a cure.
Armand, can I just say, in kids, the cutest thing is that when they don't want to cry, you know, the chin, it starts to tremble.
Yeah.
Isn't that the most adorable
thing?
It's
adorable because kind of
children do that.
They have a little chinny thing.
And it just starts to tremble. The chin
and
only.
You can see it, and
it's because they don't want to show you that they're angry with you or something, or that you have hurt their feelings or something. And it's so adorable because that's how they keep the tears in. But you can see the trembling in the chin.
The trembling chin.
Yeah.
That may be right past where Leonardo da Vinci used to have his hose going down to the heart. Hey, let's talk about this depression. Let's talk about this thing about crying. Now, look, friends. It is common belief that if a person cries, they're going to open themselves up. We are looking to elicit strong emotions and tears, and we are saying that it is usually to the advantage of a person who is depressed, to get themselves to cry. Now, crying is very different than weeping, because depressed people do weep.
Yes, there's a big difference. If you look at the behavior, you'll see that weeping involves a contraction, a containment of emotional energy, a containment of expression, a containment of the self-expression, whereas crying is the opposite, seems to be the opposite. There is an explosion almost. There's a movement outwards of the self, of the expression of the self, as well as of the emotional energy that is behind the tears. So when we look at the studies that, for instance, look at the levels of immunity and as they correlate to crying because something has reached a sad conclusion is good, is immune enhancing, whereas weeping that goes on and on and on for something that has no solution, that never seems to end, that has an immunosuppressive effect. And therefore, contrary to what a lot of people believe, that kind of crying is not health supportive and is not conducive to an improvement in the mood of the person nor to a feeling of relief. In fact, the more one weeps, the more there is a tendency to weep. It seems to perpetuate itself.
And the more depressed you get. Now,
Yes. Now
look at this. Imagine if you're a therapist who doesn't have a soundproof office. You say, we could have catharsis if the client is crying. So a depressed client comes in, and they come in depressed, and they start to weep. And the therapist says, there's emotional expression. They're weeping. So you put your hand on their shoulder, and you tell them, go ahead, continue weeping. What you're doing is fostering the illness.
That's right.
The depression is now working against itself. The person is getting sicker by the minute.
That's right.
If instead you get that person to go from weeping to crying, which you can do if you're not too worried about your neighbors, and you do that very often by including in their crying techniques some kind of movement. I mean, how many of you have gone into your cars, those of you who have cars, and you feel like weeping, and then suddenly you smash the dashboard and you shout at the top of your lungs? Boy, I'll tell you, depression, if you go into your car and you do it, or you do it in the privacy of your basement, or you do it with a pillow in front of you, and you shout at the top of your lungs and you cry your heart, you'll feel better.
Yes, because you're releasing that excessive energy that is stimulating your nervous system. And I think your friend Armand Peter Levine, It Won't Hurt Forever, he wrote the book and did a series on audio tapes. He studied that often when people have very strong emotions and they're not able to physically express them, the emotional energy gets kind of stuck in the nervous system, trapped in the body, and it causes a tension that is very uncomfortable and that transforms itself into all kinds of symptoms. That's because there's an excessive stimulation of the nerves. Crying, in that way, when it opens up the energy flow, relieves that tension and discharges, allows the person to discharge the excessive emotional intensity. You can think of it as electricity, even.
There's an article called When Remembering the Lost Spouse Hurts Too Much, and this is by Hans Znoj, Z-N-O-J. You could search it up on your websites and look at it. And what Hans said here that was very important was that in weeping over bereavement, you may never get over the bereaved person. In fact, you may be dropping your immune system, and this may be the reason why when a spouse dies, the next spouse soon follows.
Right.
Because they are weeping. What has been said about the process of mourning is that you have to eventually reach a number of stages, including anger and rage, over the death of the person. Well, what does that do? That gets you from weeping to crying.
Yeah.
And the crying is cathartic because it actually does release, and it's one of the best ways of letting go of the dead partner without you having to follow them. These are big statements coming from somebody who's worked with people for a number of years. But
it's interesting. And I mean, now as I listen to you, I think of babies, Armand, those babies in the orphanages, when they stop crying, that's a bad sign, because for as long as they have the energy to cry, it means that they're able to ask for help for what they need. But when they stop, usually that means that they've given up.
Listen, this is Armand DeMille and Roberta Ati. Kind of fabulous stuff, yeah, Roberta, you know, really stuff. If people want a copy of today's program, they would call 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. You can send me an email, Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at BrainLink, B-R-A-I-N-L-I-N-K. You can reach Roberta at Roberta4Health.
The number four.
The number four in the middle at AOL.com. Whew. Good stuff, Roberta.
Thank you, Armand.